Shrink Wrap Radio number 296, Critiquing Positive Psychology as Cancer Treatment with Dr. James Coyne.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is research psychologist Dr. James C. Coyne, who is director of the Behavioral Oncology Program and professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. We're going to be discussing his research on the effects of positive psychology interventions on cancer patients. To learn more about Dr. Coyne, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. James Coyne, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, as you know, I was referred to you by Dr. Stephen Soltz, who I interviewed recently about his critique of Martin Seligman's Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. And he suggested you as a good follow-on because you've been testing some of the assertions of positive psychology in relation to cancer.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's start really broad, and then we can focus in on specifics as we go along. I gather you've been testing the assumptions of positive psychology in relation to cancer for some time. How many years has it been?
Oh, I'd say now probably about 15 years.
Oh, okay. Well, that is as long or longer than the term positive psychology.
Yeah, I guess I got interested in some of these ideas before the label positive psychology became attached to them. I was particularly interested if taking a positive attitude towards cancer would make any difference for cancer patient survival.
Yeah, and that notion, that assertion, certainly predates the label of positive psychology.
Absolutely. It goes back to, I guess, sometime in the early 70s, an English group developed a concept of fighting spirit, and they believed that they had found evidence that patients who adopted an attitude of fighting spirit lasted longer. They survived longer.
Well, I'm going to be asking you about fighting spirit specifically in just a moment.
Sure.
But before we get there, I guess a key assertion of positive psychology, and not just positive psychology, but various spiritual and philosophical traditions, is that our thoughts and attitudes can impact our health. In general, what's your take on that notion?
Well, I think it can affect our emotional health. But I think that the links to physical health have been exaggerated.
Okay, so it's, exaggeration is the term rather than it's impossible, because I would think that our emotional health would have some tie-ins with our physical health, and I believe that's been demonstrated.
Well, certainly I think we're on firmer ground with heart disease than we are with cancer. Mm-hmm. And we certainly know that, particularly after a heart attack, patients who are depressed are more likely to have another heart attack, and they're also more likely to die.
Okay.
But the question is that really the is it depression, or is it because they're more ill and physically ill, and it looks like depression?
Yeah. Well, from looking at your papers, I can tell that you're a very careful scientist and that you don't take anything for granted, and you do your best to tease out these various factors.
Sure.
Now you mentioned fighting spirit, and that's one of the things that you've looked at in terms of cancer. And I think we've all heard that you'll fare better as a hospital patient if you're feisty, right?
Well, if that's your nature, and I think it's, you might as well just be yourself. But I also think that if that's not a patient's natural inclination, there's no particular benefit to them to adopt that attitude.
Well, I guess that's reassuring to me because I'm kind of meek and mild by nature, I know I would have difficulty making a ruckus in the hospital. So I hope you're right about that. So what have you found out about fighting spirit in relation to, you know, and you may want to define fighting spirit a little bit more, but what have you found in relation to cancer incidence, cancer survival time, cancer mortality? And you could take your time and explain it as in as much depth as you wish.
Yeah, the original research was done by a psychologist in England, Stephen Geer, and with another psychologist, Maggie Watson. And they had a modest sample in which they were trying to explain, I believe, about 7 deaths. And most of the cancer patients survived, and there were only 7 deaths they were trying to explain. And when they did some fancy statistics, they seemed to find that the patients who had adopted an attitude of fighting spirit, a mental attitude, and this was involved refusing to let having cancer disrupt their life, and basically wanting to take it on, and so they published that finding, and then they got the funds to do a much larger study. And they found absolutely no relationship to whether the attitude that patients adopted and their survival time. And for Maggie Watson, that was sort of reassuring because she was always uncomfortable with the implications of the research. Did that mean that they would have to encourage cancer patients to have a positive attitude? And she worried if some of them nonetheless died, would they blame themselves? And so she saw something that I certainly picked up on, the possibility that encouraging a positive attitude would actually harm patients' well-being, in that when they inevitably, many of them succumb to cancer, they and their family members would blame them for not having had a positive attitude. And so they wrote up their study, and she had control of the way they wrote up their discussion, and she said that she was reassured. When Stephen Geer realized that, he actually wrote a critique of his own study and attacked that, and they fought it out for a while, but there was never convincing evidence after that that there was any relationship between fighting spirit and survival. And looking back on the original study, they probably unwittingly did some statistical tricks. There was probably a chance finding there, and the fancy multivariate analyses they did weren't appropriate to the data.
Interesting. You know, you talk in one of your papers that you sent me, you refer to the tyranny of the positive. I think you were quoting somebody else, and I think that's what you were just talking about there in terms of Maggie's concerns about the person being blamed either by family or blaming themselves. And that's something I can really relate to. Actually, I see it kind of as the dark underbelly of a lot of the New Age health, New Age movement, where there's a lot of emphasis on thinking positive and being positive. And the dark side of that is that somebody may accuse you, oh, well, you weren't positive enough, and with the unspoken accusation that it's your fault.
Absolutely. And I picked up that term from a cancer survivor, Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote a great book called Bright Sided.
Sure, I read that.
Yeah. And she, when she was diagnosed with cancer, she was quite angry. It was quite inconvenient to have cancer. She had some writing projects ahead, and all of a sudden her life is at risk, and she's got treatments that make her sick, and she was quite unhappy with that. And she went to some support groups and expressed her anger at her cancer. She hated her cancer. And the patients were horrified, and they suggested that she needed therapy. And so she dropped, and they put a lot of pressure on her, so she dropped out of those groups. There are some illnesses in which they encourage you to hate your illness. There's certainly patients with diabetes are encouraged that they can hate their diabetes and do their best to fight it. But that's because they've got tasks up ahead that they can manage, and that throwing yourself into the task, managing your diabetes, makes a difference for your how much diabetes affects your life and how many complications you develop. And so it makes a perfect sense there. But in cancer, there's nothing particularly that you have to do to fight.
Well, I can really relate to that on a personal level because my mother died of colon cancer, and she had kind of undergone a spiritual conversion or reconversion somewhere in that process, and she had a remission for a while where she was going around proclaiming that God had healed her of her cancer. And then when she relapsed, she was filled with self-recrimination and guilt, feeling like she hadn't held on to her faith.
Absolutely. And I think that there are many cancer patients, the biology of the disease is such, there isn't much that can be done. They can affect the course, you know, with chemotherapy. They can affect pain levels, but ultimately the course is pretty well set. And I think there often are phases where they feel less affected by the treatment, or there is a lull and they're feeling bad, and they'll often adopt a positive attitude, but then they're confronted by the reality of their continued decline. And I think that they need all the help they can in coming to terms. You know, coping with cancer isn't a matter of being positive or negative. There's other things like being open to what's going on, suspending judgment, or when the end is near, accepting that the end is near and appropriately putting your life in order. And I think that the encouragement to think positive often gets in the way of people putting their lives in order at the end.
Okay, now another factor that you've looked at is something you call benefit finding. What do you mean by benefit finding? Yeah, what do you mean by benefit finding?
Okay, that was an invention of Michael and Tony, a cancer researcher from the University of Miami. And he had some group therapy for breast cancer patients. And it was involved a lot of relaxation exercises. And they tried different ones every week for 10 weeks. And the results weren't impressive in terms of the ability of these relaxation exercises to leave the patients less anxious. But then he invented a variable after the study was done, benefit finding, and he claimed that the engaging in these relaxation exercises helped the cancer patients to find more benefit in having cancer. And I frankly wasn't sure that was a good idea. And so he persisted in that claim. But now we know a lot more about benefit finding, and frankly, it seems to be an illusion.
Now, I'm assuming that by benefit finding, you're referring to a person reframing the experience and looking for the growth opportunity in it or a chance to turn their lives around.
Absolutely. And you can find all sorts of testimonials on the web.
Sure.
And people who claim that cancer was the greatest thing that ever happened to them. And but what we find out is that they often really, they say that and they really believe it. But in the rare instances where we have evaluations of their life that were made before they got cancer, we find that what they're actually doing is reevaluating the way life used to be. They're evaluating it more negatively rather than having gotten any benefit. So they'll look back on their past life and they'll sort of revise their life story and say, you know, things were so terrible then. I was not a good person, and then I got cancer and all these positive changes. And it seems to be an illusion rather than there was actually any real benefit. There's a great book by John Diamond. He's a English he was an English journalist. And he was told that he had cancer, but he was told that it was not going to be life-threatening. And so he began writing a column about his experiences having cancer. And then he found out that it was indeed a terminal diagnosis, and he was facing his last days. And he got so angry at people telling him that he should be positive, he should find a benefit. He actually sent out Christmas cards to some of his friends saying, and he had a wicked sense of humor, Merry Christmas. I hope the coming year you get cancer too and find all the benefits that I have.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, clearly he meant that in a darkly humorous way. And people who know him understood that. But he wrote a great book, Even Cowards Get Cancer Too.
Hmm. Well, you know, I have to be upfront with you and say that there's a one part of my brain that's still holding out, still invested in some of these ideas, despite the findings that you're reporting. And, you know, I want to be open to what you're saying, but at the same time, I think sometimes laboratory research can lag behind, you know, what's happening in the real world, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. You know, but it also, there's something fundamental that disturbs our sense of control to believe that we are facing an illness and that there's nothing that we can do that'll influence its outcome.
Yeah. Again, I want to share a personal story. I have an adult son who had stage 4 cancer, and fortunately he's now been clear for 5 years as a result of chemo and radiation and, you know, all of the stuff that they do. He has turned his life around. He was in a dead-end job. He had no forward momentum, no career really in mind, and was just kind of drifting and treading water. And as a result of that experience, he decided that he really needed to have to be pursuing a more meaningful life. And right now he's in the process of becoming a nurse practitioner. And very happy and very engaged and very dedicated.
Well, I have no doubt that those sorts of things happen. But on average, I think a couple things. People who claim to find benefit in from having cancer or other major traumatic events are no better adjusted than those who find no benefit. Secondly, a lot of the supposed benefits that cancer patients find are basically revisions of how their life used to be. But I have no doubt there are some people whose lives are transformed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the Netherlands, where I teach part-time at the University of Groningen, I teach health psychology, and I'm constantly, people bring up this Olympic swimmer, Martin van Vien. And he's a remarkable man. He was a Olympic swimmer, and then he was diagnosed with cancer. And he went through treatment, and he went into remission, and he went on to win the Olympics. And people said, oh, now we have the Dutch Lance Armstrong. We want him to go on TV and talk shows and promote defeating cancer. And he got very upset with that. He said, you know, when I won the Olympic gold medal, it's because I really worked hard. It was the focus of my life, and I threw myself into it. When I was told I had cancer, all I did was submit to the diagnosis, and I did what the doctor asked. There was no fight. There was no struggle. There was nothing else for me to do. And I really don't think it's fair to people, other cancer patients, for me to be held up as a model, because I don't believe I'm a model. I don't believe it was the fighting spirit that got me a gold medal is not what got me through my cancer. And I think that's a profound statement.
Yeah, and you mentioned Lance Armstrong, of course, who is very well known. And he certainly had the personality before cancer came along of just being a terribly driven, committed athlete.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's a tremendous inspiration. I think he's inspired a lot of cancer patients. I think he's been a wonderful fundraiser for cancer treatment and for cancer research. But I think he's a terrible model for some ordinary people who just can't be a Lance Armstrong because they happen to have had cancer. Okay. And it's a tremendous burden.
Yeah, I hear the burden part. Let me just test your religion a bit more. How can it be a bad thing to look for a growth opportunity when something bad befalls us, to turn lemons into lemonade, as the saying goes?
Well, there's some interesting research by Camille Wertman, and she looks at people who have lost a relative to an automobile accident. And she looks at their struggles to find meaning in that. And she finds that some of the worst adjusted people are the people who look for meaning and can't find it. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that it has to be a message. There has to be something good. And if they don't find it, they feel worse. Whereas those who think they've found meaning in it actually aren't better adjusted than those who didn't bother to try in the first place. There are lots of things, lots of thought processes. There's mourning, there's a sense of loss that when someone loses a relative to an automobile accident. But the pathways of our thought isn't necessarily toward, well, what is the meaning of this? What is the benefit to it?
You've been quoting a number of individual studies, and I'm glad that you have been. I'm under the impression, though, that you've done a number of meta-analyses on these questions where you've looked at a whole lot of studies. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's a whole scandal to one of them, which I can talk about. There are a number of meta-analyses and systematic reviews that claim to have shown that psychological characteristics predicted the onset of cancer, the progression of cancer, and then the outcome, namely death. And if you actually look at the studies, most of them are quite modest, and then there's some wild outliers. There's a set of studies that someone named Hans Eysenck, an English psychologist, did.
Yeah, famous guy.
Yeah, and he should be infamous.
Oh, really? Okay.
What happened, and this is well documented, he was convinced that personality caused smoking. And so he's convinced that certain personality types were inclined to smoke. And there's certainly evidence that's true. But he went further than that. He was convinced that certain personality types get cancer. So he came up with the wild idea that personality caused smoking, and there's some evidence that it causes vulnerability to smoking, and personality caused lung cancer, and the apparent relationship between smoking and lung cancer was an illusion. It was so-called spurious. It was just due to personality being relating to both of the variables, smoking and lung cancer, and not to them smoking being causal. Well, many years later, and he published some studies with a colleague from Croatia named Grasik Matusik, and he published them in his own journal. And they claim to have a strong relationship between personality and cancer. And not only that, they claimed that modifying personality modified risk for cancer. These results inspired a lot of skepticism, and people went and looked at the data, and they found that there was fraud.
Mm.
But worse, a number of years later, there were suits in the United States against the tobacco company that eventually ended up in the big settlement. And when the papers of the law firm were subpoenaed, they revealed the payment of £800,000 or $1.6 million to Hans Eysenck to promote the idea that there was no relationship between smoking and lung cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's no doubt these data were fraud and they were purchased, and he never disclosed that they'd been purchased. But the idea is so compelling that it keeps showing up in meta-analyses, and I actually have an alert on my computer, and every week when it gets updated for the new studies, if anybody cites his study, I get notified by the PubMed bibliographic service, and I write critiques of the and suggest that we need to get this out of the literature. So, if a typical study has a relationship between, psychological variable and outcome of cancer, it'll be in the range of maybe a hazard ratio of maybe 1.05, something like that. So it means that there's a very slight effect of personality. And then when you take into account, well, are you really measuring personality or are you measuring how ill people are, it tends to go away. But then you have a risk factor of 64. And there is the Ising study way out there in the middle of nowhere by itself. And it suggested that people with a certain personality are 64 times more likely to get cancer. And it's nonsense. There are known biological factors for cancer. Let's take cervical cancer. HPV virus causes cervical cancer. The relationship isn't as strong as Ising claimed for personality. And so that just further underlines it's nonsense. We know it's fraudulent, but it keeps getting into the data. It's almost like my Italian grandmother says, said, if it isn't true, it ought to be. It's just so compelling.
Right. I can relate to that. So you've looked at whether or not enhanced benefit improves immune functioning and survival.
Yeah, and the notion there is that we have little clue in about how the immune system, at least the parts of it that we can measure, affect cancer. We know that in some cases, cancer is treated like it's a foreign body. It mobilizes the immune system. And the immune system, it can't overcome the tumor, but it nonetheless stimulates the immune system. So we see the immune system aroused, but there isn't any benefit to that. In other instances, the immune system and the cancer development are totally separate. But there are also some instances in which the tumor can kind of hijack the immune system and fight off the other body's defenses. And so the bottom line is how the role of the immune system in cancer is much more complex than some of these simplistic models that people have. People like Michael Antoni, again, who claims that by getting benefit finding going, you strengthen the immune system, and therefore you can extend the body's ability to fight cancer. But there isn't evidence that stimulating the immune system affects outcome of cancer. Not only that, there's no evidence that psychological interventions affect the outcome of cancer in terms of biological terms, in terms of survival.
A closely related topic to what we've been discussing is the notion of post-traumatic growth, which you also take on. Am I right that this is an idea that Martin Seligman has put forward? I seem to recall that from his presentation at the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology, which I attended in Philadelphia.
Like a lot of ideas in positive psychology, it started elsewhere, but it was sort of incorporated into positive psychology. And like a lot of the ideas, there's very little evidence that post-traumatic growth is related to any changed physical outcomes.
Okay.
There are a lot of these myths that, you know, again, like my grandmother would say, if they aren't true, they ought to be, because it makes a great story. It's about the triumph of the human spirit, the triumph of the human will, but the evidence just isn't there.
And I guess closely related to that is something you refer to as problems with recalling personal change.
Exactly.
Yeah, how does that apply here?
There are lots of personality studies, and they involve people maybe they're in a cohort, maybe they'll be in med school together, and or they'll be in college or in high school together, and they take personality tests. And then there's an effort to recontact them later, and they do two things. They're asked to take a personality measure now, but they're also asked to fill out the questionnaire the way they thought they did when they were in med school or high school. And they find that consistently, these studies, people are not good at recalling their personality. And there are a lot of biases about the way things are going now and the way we want to explain the way things are going now in terms of how they influence our reconstruction of the past. So, and I think a lot of the phenomena associated with that.
Yeah, so you're saying there's a problem when people say they've grown as a result of a traumatic experience.
Mostly we have no way of knowing one way or the other, but in the instances in which we do have background data that was uninfluenced by the traumatic experience, we find out that they're recalling it different than it actually was.
Okay. And again, I want to make reference to the fact that in the research publications you sent me, I saw that you'd carried out a number of meta-analyses. And just so our listeners understand, that's an approach where you look at not just a single study, but bring lots of studies together to increase the data, the size of the data pool that the findings are based on. And so looking into many of these things, you actually, by doing meta-analyses, were able to look at not 5 or 10 subjects, but thousands.
Yeah, the idea is that any one study has its flaws. It has its limitations in terms of how representative the sample is, or that there may be things that weren't done particularly well. But if you get a lot of studies and you find ways of combining them, statistical ways, then you can overcome the limitations of any one study and get a finding that you have more confidence in.
Yes, yes. Do you dismiss positive psychology altogether?
No, but I think that much of it that is novel is wrong, and much of it is right on target is not novel. So I would say much of the positive psychology that is new isn't right, and much of it that is right is not new.
You know, I can relate to that because one of the things I discovered when I went to that conference, and that also just knew on my own, is that positive psychology is such a broad rubric that there's tons of different areas of research that can get their nose under that tent. And to paint a broad brush about positive psychology, you know, there are people who've devoted their whole research career to studying some aspect of psychology that's related, but that predates the label of positive psychology.
And positive psychology is money making. I think as Dr. Soltz has probably mentioned to you, there was $131 million devoted to the comprehensive soldier fitness project, and that was the idea was that positive psychology would protect American servicemen from battlefield stress, and now we actually have some data about how that program is going. And the effects are minuscule. There's barely measurable effects. And it's been an enormous waste of money. And I think it's too bad. Think of what we could do with $131 million to affect the lives of people who have faced traumatic stress on the battlefield and need help adjusting.
Yes. Now, in one of your articles, you referred to positive psychology as creating a storyline resistance to evidence. Is this in relation to cancer only or more generally?
Well, I think that there's a bandwagon, and positive psychology has no monopoly on resistance to evidence. I think that when people have strongly held beliefs, their first inclination is when they run into contradictory evidence is to try to explain away that evidence. And paradoxically, we know from cognitive psychology that often when confronted with contrary evidence, people with strongly held beliefs hold on to the beliefs even more strongly. And I think that's what's happened. There are a lot of true believers. It's kind of a cult. It's kind of a religion.
In fact, you've written about publication biases in relation to positive psychology and a failure to consider dissent.
Absolutely. It's very tough. And say the American Psychologist will commission a special issue, an entire issue devoted to comprehensive soldier fitness program. And they'll ask Marty Seligman to write it, to edit it. Now, supposedly it's going to be peer-reviewed, that people are going to be able to get their manuscripts reviewed and will presumably will alter their manuscripts based on the feedback of the peer reviewers. But what we find happening is that when special editions are put out like this, particularly American Psychologists, there's no room for dissent. People aren't asked to contribute articles. And people who manage to slip into the peer review, who have a contrary opinion, get ignored. And there are a number of people who have complained about having been reviewers of, say, the special issue of American Psychologist, given scathing reviews, and then having gotten ignored. Peer review breaks down.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this more generally a problem that journals tend to publish positive results and not so much negative results?
Absolutely. But again, there's lots of money in play. Marty Seligman has established awards for positive psychology. And not only do people get research grants, but they get money in their pocket for contributions to positive psychology. And I think that that affects their decisions about how they spin their findings.
Yeah, but I mean, positive psychology aside, just in psychology in general.
Oh, absolutely.
A doctoral student, if the doctoral student's research doesn't have any positive findings to report, he's probably not going to move ahead and get his degree, and he's not going to get published.
Absolutely. There are lots of confirmatory biases out there. Journals are much more interested in positive findings than in negative findings. I did one of the largest studies ever done about the relationship between mood and survival in cancer patients. This was with a sample of 900 radiation therapy patients. And we found absolutely no relationship between measures of mood and how long the patients lived after we controlled for biological variables like severity of the cancer, progression, and these sorts of things. And it was a very careful study with lots of biological variables, so we're pretty confident in our results. And we had a hard time publishing it. And one journal said, when you have no findings, there's no interest, period.
But that is a finding. That sounds like
exactly.
A very important finding.
So, you know, I have a blog, The Skeptical Sleuth, and I go around looking at papers that claim to have unusual positive findings, and I often find they're exaggerated or they can't be replicated. Like, for instance, I did a blog on we all know that because of the power of mind that people can affect their time of death so that they miss certain holidays. They're able to live for certain holidays. Like we know that I believe it was both Washington and Adams died on the 4th of July, and that must say something about them wanting to live to anniversary of the independence of the United States. But if you actually go through the literature, you find that it's very biased. So there was some findings that Jewish people were more likely to make it through Passover, and that was widely publicized. But when you looked at other Jewish holidays, it didn't work. Similarly, when you look at Chinese people and whether or not they make it through Chinese New Year, there's no relationship. But you don't hear about these negative findings. You hear about the sensationalized positive findings.
Okay. So to kind of sum up, what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of the positive psychology enterprise overall, not just in relation to cancer?
Well, it's certainly thrown a lot of resources into studying some issues that were neglected. And many of its ideas may ultimately prove to be false, but they weren't given the critical look that they otherwise they wouldn't have been given a critical look. For instance, we know that there are lots of self-help exercises that work well when people are mildly depressed or unhappy. They can make them happier. But I think positive psychology has helped to show that doesn't mean they can keep going and get more happier and happier. So there's what we call the hedonic treadmill. Mm-hmm. The notion is that you would be very happy if you found out that you'd just been given a Mercedes. And you'd be delighted, you felt it would change your life. But very shortly, and we know this from psychological studies of sudden gifts, sure, it would become less of a factor in your life that you had a Mercedes. And if you wanted to have that effect, you'd probably have to get a second Mercedes, and that wouldn't last. So the hedonic treadmill is that we keep readjusting what we need to feel positive, and we're on a treadmill. We can't ever live happily ever after. That only happens in fairy tales, and they end that way because they don't know how to do it. They say, and they lived happily ever after. They don't tell us how to do it because no one knows. And I think that what happened is that positive psychology took the interesting notion that if something can make us go from unhappy to happy, maybe it can even make us more happy. And that hasn't hasn't worked out. And that's an achievement.
But positive psychologists do talk about the hedonic treadmill.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they talk about that as a limitation, and
yep,
that therefore, you know, that's kind of referring to hedonistic kinds of pleasures, but that
absolutely,
they point us towards more enduring sources of happiness, such as finding meaning in one's life, helping others, generosity, gratitude, etc.
And that's a model for some people some of the time. I think there are a lot of perfectly happy people out there. For some people, the unexamined life is a pretty happy life.
Right.
And what they can do is disturb that.
Though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've kind of run through my questions. I wonder if there's more information that you'd like to introduce here or anything that you'd like to add.
I would just, you know, like to return the issue of cancer because there's something near and dear to my heart about this. I personally think that support groups have a lot of benefit for cancer patients. And if they're so inclined, they ought to go to them with the expectation that they can get support and a chance to talk about their experience. They can talk about their experience with other people who are going through the same thing in a way that maybe they may be better understood than with their friends and relatives who don't have the cancer experience. I encourage cancer patients to check those out. But I get I'm displeased when patients who otherwise wouldn't go to a support group go there only on the promise it'll extend their life. That's a false promise, and we shouldn't mislead them. And it takes away from what support groups can do,
okay,
namely help people feel better in the life that they have.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Dr. James Coyne, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome, and I appreciate the chance to express my ideas.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. James Coyne. He really challenges some of the more optimistic claims of the positive psychology movement. As you heard me say, I have trouble dismissing some of those claims myself, despite the evidence he presents. I probably suffer from cognitive bias and denial. At the same time, however, I do believe that what can be more or less proven in formal psychological research is sometimes at odds with experience and perhaps with reality. both lab experiments and questionnaires suffer from limitations that fall short of the complexity of real-world situations. And as long as one doesn't take on that New Age guilt, or what Barbara Ehrenreich has termed the tyranny of the positive, I think positive thoughts and attitudes are likely to be beneficial to those who are drawn to such practices, and perhaps even to those who are not. I'm not ready to throw it all out. In the show notes on our shrinkwrapradio.com website, I'll put a link to a CBS News television story in which Dr. Coyne appears along with Barbara Ehrenreich and Lance Armstrong, among others. It's a short feature that examines both sides of the question. I think you'll enjoy it and find support for whichever side of the question you're on.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Surprise! Here I am again already. The folks at MentalHelp.net have decided to stop supporting Wise Counsel podcast, and that means I'm probably going to be putting out a Shrink Wrap Radio episode on a more or less weekly basis. I've got a few more Wise Counsel episodes in the queue, but I've got so many potential guests that I want to interview and so many good ones that you folks suggest in your emails that I thought I just better get on it. The Shrink Wrap Radio episodes have always been more work than the Wise Counsel ones because I tend to do longer interviews here, put more of myself into my post-interview comments, have this announcement section and a listener email section, and none of those exist on Wise Counsel. So some of the time, just to keep up, I may need to shorten some of those up. Longtime listeners may recall that twice before in the past, I've done a series of interviews in connection with an International Association for the Study of Dreams conference. Well, once again, they're having their meetings near me, and I've decided it's time to give them some coverage again. The International Association for the Study of Dreams is holding its 29th annual International Conference, Sailing on the Sea of Dreams, at the Berkeley Marina DoubleTree this year, June 22nd through the 26th. It's a 4.5-day event open to the public with over 170 presenters from around the globe offering workshops, lectures, panels, and special events. Keynote speakers this year are Fred Allen Wolf, Ph.D., a.k.a. Dr. Quantum, who starred in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, Patricia Garfield, Ph.D., prize-winning author of over 11 books on dreams, and researcher Tracy Kahn, Ph.D. Special events include receptions where you can meet with world-famous authors, researchers, and experts on dreams, a dream exhibition, a dream telepathy contest, a costume dream ball, a dream hike along the bay, and a sunset cruise on the San Francisco Bay. So go to www.asdreams.org for information and to register. I'll be conducting a couple of interviews here with presenters before the conference, and I'm planning to attend the conference myself, and you can expect I'll most likely conduct a number of short interviews with attendees and presenters there at the conference facility. If you decide to go, be sure to find me and say hi. I'll probably be wearing my Shrink Wrap Radio shirt or cap or Shrink Wrap Radio microphone. We have a new transcript on the site, I'm happy to say, thanks to Alma Maria Renaz in Mexico for transcribing number 293, A Jungian Approach to Fairy Tales with Tom Elsner. That was a really good one, and I know you'll be happy to have that transcript available. I know I am. Once again, let me remind you to go to the store tab on our site if you have any need for continuing education units. I also want to remind you that we have a Yahoo discussion group, and you can join that if you're not already a member by clicking on the purple badge toward the bottom of the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. And I hope you'll remember to make all your Amazon.com purchases through the badge in that same right-hand sidebar, as well as purchasing any of the recommended books that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar as well. I want to thank all of you who've made donations to help keep this show going. We have three really standout supporters who I've mentioned before: John Homestead, a counselor in the Bahamas, who made a year-long pledge of $35 a month, along with a challenge to everyone else to top his pledge. Katie Morrison of Morrison Mentoring in Melbourne has pledged $30 a month, as has Peter Myron. I'm extremely appreciative for the support not only of these three top donors, but also for all those others of you who've made continuing or one-time donations of various amounts. However, as I've said in the past, a lot more work goes into producing this series than we're compensated for, and that's especially the case since losing the support of MentalHelp.net for Wise Counsel. So I really hope you'll join these other supporters by clicking on the big green donate button on our site. Enough said.
Hi, this is UCLA professor and co-author of Engineering Happiness, Dr. Rakesh Sareen, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, I conducted the interview with Dr. Rakesh Sareen earlier this very day, and he was very warm and delightful. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Elizabeth in Austin, Texas, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I donated $50 to your show this morning. I hope to be a regular donor. I'm a pretty new but very avid fan." Well, I guess so. She goes on to say, "I found you first on Wise Counsel when I was looking for a podcast about bipolar disorder to supplement what I'm learning in my abnormal psychology class. But I've been focusing more on shrink wrap right now because I'm enjoying learning about Jung. I'm in grad school studying counseling, but in my theories class, we skipped over Jung. I especially appreciated the interview with Jean Shinoda Bolen. I'm trying to find my own identity as a political activist, and she is a great model. So I just wanted to say thank you for supplementing my formal education." And that is from Elizabeth in Austin. And Elizabeth, I'm so impressed that you as a graduate student would make such a handsome contribution of $50. I really appreciate that. And you know, I've heard from so many others that they're not getting Jung covered in their graduate program. That was true when I was in graduate school as well, and unfortunately, it's still widely the case, although there are alternative graduate programs that have sprung up in the intervening years, and so there are places where people are getting that exposure. But Shrink Wrap Radio has been and will continue to be one of the primary places where students can look forward to filling in some of those gaps. Next, we hear from Dr. Stuart Kaplan, who wrote to say, "Dear Dr. Van Nuys, I wish to be considered for an interview on your radio show. I'm the author of Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder, How Bad Science and Good Public Relations Created the Diagnosis." And he gives his website, which is notchildbipolardisorder.com. And he's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Pennsylvania State College of Medicine. He says, "I note that we both blog for Psychology Today. My blog is Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder." He says, "Marilyn Wedge, PhD, recommended you to me." And Marilyn Wedge, you may recall, is someone I interviewed on Wise Counsel. And he concludes, "Thanks for your consideration. Regards, Stuart L. Kaplan, MD." And in fact, I've taken him up on his offer, and we've scheduled that interview is probably about a month away. So I think that should be a very informative one. And it strikes me as fairly synchronistic that Stuart Kaplan should show up just on the heels of my reading the email from Elizabeth, who was looking for more information on bipolar disorder. So, Elizabeth, I hope you'll be around to hear this. So, with that, we will wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Or you can download our iPhone app or Android app, which I forgot to mention, and you can leave voicemail directly using that. So thanks again to researcher Dr. James Coyne for sharing his critique of positive psychology in relation to cancer. Interestingly, my next episode will feature an interview back on the pro side of positive psychology. Dr. Rakesh Sarin is an engineer and a UCLA business professor who has co-written a book with another engineering professor, and the title of their book is Engineering Happiness. Engineers who want to engineer happiness? Is that chutzpah or what? Well, you'll have to listen to the next episode and make up your own mind. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying it is all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.